Welcome to the Breaking Health Podcast, a series of discussions with the most disruptive CEOs and leaders in digital health.
Welcome to the Breaking Health Podcast. I'm here with John Kao, the founder and CEO of Alignment Healthcare. Good to see you, John.
Hey, Steve. Good to be here.
As you know, you've got a great background, so I want to get into Alignment and the business and what you're up to today. But I was actually, you know, as companies start to go out and go public, I was seeing the prospectus, and I was very moved by the letter that you wrote in the opening remarks of, to open the prospectus, and it gives a little bit of sense of your story. But for our listeners, give us the founding story of Alignment from your early career to when you decided to start the company, and to give us a sense for why you're crazy enough to be an entrepreneur in the first place.
Yeah, no, thanks, Steve. It's a very personal, kind of story. It forms the basis, you know, the foundation of what we're doing. But just quickly, my background in healthcare really started with a company called FHP way back in, 1990s. I'm dating myself, but
yeah.
But I learned about staff models. I learned about vertical integration. I then joined a company called PacifiCare and Secure Horizons that was really around provider partnerships and really managing seniors in Medicare Advantage. And that business grew to 1.5 million seniors. It was ultimately sold to United. And then I was with a company called TriZetto, which back in the day was a leading HCIT core system company. And really, I learned about systems and processes and workflows and a bit about technology. And then I went to a company and really bought a company called CareMore. And there we learned about bending the cost curve and chronic disease management, and really had the thesis that really with data, you understood that 20% of the population accounted for 80% of the spend. And so you kind of weave all those backgrounds together, and you kind of get Alignment Healthcare. And so the kind of the convergence of all of that really inspired me in really 2013 when I went through a personal issue with my mother. And she had a heart attack. I get this call on a Sunday morning. I'm having my cup of coffee, and she just screaming at me in Chinese, and, get over here, get over here. I got to go over there. And when I was there, the paramedics were there, the ambulance was there, fire station was there. I mean, like, everybody was there, and they had to break into the house, get her. They took her to the hospital, and within 45 minutes, she was in, the cath lab. She had three stents put in. She's had 3 days in ICU, 3 days in telemetry. And this is what, 7 years ago now. The most frightening thing occurred when she was being discharged. And it's like nobody knew anything. And so having the background that I did, I obviously engaged and tried to help her and support her. And I was overwhelmed and confused. And so basically, I just concluded at that moment in time, I said, I can't be the only person going through this.
Right.
Where effectively I am the advocate for my, aging parent, and there is no support system, no advocacy out there that is there that I can turn to. There's like nobody, literally nobody. And certainly the health plan that was that she was insured with had no understanding, interest of any of it. And the entire experience was disjointed, uncoordinated, et cetera. So that's when I said, "We there's got to be a better way. There's got to be a better way." And I, again, there's 60 some odd million seniors in this country, and I can't be the only one going through this.
Right.
And so, you know, that's why we started the business, to you know, change the experience that seniors have, and have them have somebody they can trust to help them through the whole healthcare navigation system. That's why we did it.
It's funny. I have older parents too. I'm blessed with the fact that both my parents are still with me, but they're now getting to the age where they're interacting with the healthcare system.
Yep.
And I'm always very surprised by the absence of information.
Yep.
And the absence of just, you know, fundamental, you know, if you think of it as a customer, customer service that's there either from the provider or the health plan. I just had a recent experience where I said to myself, you know, I don't know which side of the bell curve this medical team is on. I don't know if they're the geniuses or not, but they were very proactive in giving me information about what was going on. Mm-hmm. And very direct about the risks, very direct about the benefits of what was going on. Mm-hmm. And direct about whether they were successful or whether they needed to do more work across the board. And all of that made me feel like they were getting good care. I don't know whether they got the best care in the world. The outcome worked out well.
Mm-hmm.
But I said, wow, if the healthcare system could have this team of professionals replicated,
mm-hmm.
then I could see my parents having a much easier time. I always feel like I need to jump in.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, yeah. I'm sure you were basically, it was an inquisition, right? What's going on with my mother? What do we need to do for her? What can we expect?
Well,
hard to know where to get the answer.
Well, and to your point, you know, the lack of kind of consistency around the clinical information was a problem, and specifically in the form of, post-discharge home health care, for example, and or post-discharge cardiac rehab. And kind of the third thing that I had to intervene on was just the medications that were administered inside the hospital were in conflict with the medications that she had been on. I mean, so you had to like sort through all of that, and I had to go to the primary care and essentially beg them to, you know, have a home health nurse come out twice a week just to make sure she was okay. So the learning of all this, and a part of it is just from the background that I have and the learnings, you know, good and bad, you know, learnings is, you know, it's like of the 100% of the people out there, 80 to 90% are healthy. They're okay. I mean, they cost the system 10 to 20% of the overall spend of seniors we're talking about. It's that 10 to 20% that are frail, that have polychronic conditions, you know, that are declining. I mean, that's the population that cost 80% of the spend.
Mm-hmm.
And so it makes sense that we build programs and clinical models to, number one, identify who they are, and then number two, envelop them with very proactive care at the home and or virtually. And to just make sure the most vulnerable out there are taken care of. And what that does in our business is that you kind of, you know, do well by doing good.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the other thing I said in the prospectus is, you know, you've got this virtuous cycle that we kind of live by, where if you know who the polychronic frail people are, you proactively take care of them, you just envelop them and treat them like you would want your mom or your dad to be treated, like this care team that you had. You want that for every single senior in this country. And if you can do that, you're going to be able to bend the cost curve. And so if you bend the cost curve and you get high quality care delivery and good clinical outcomes at a low cost in the Medicare Advantage world, you know, we can't just take that lower cost, or let's just say higher margin. You can't just take that into profit. You have to, by law, through the annual CMS bid process, reinvest a portion of that savings back into richer benefits for the 80% of the people that are generally healthy. Mm-hmm. So you've got this virtuous cycle of you do the right thing, you take care of people that need it the most, you drive down costs, you reinvest it into really attractive, rich coverages and benefits, and that's what's fueling the growth. And so when you grow, then to the point you made also earlier is that from a member service and customer service, you take care of them, which is where you get star ratings and you know, net promoter scores. And, you know, we've been paid 4.5 out of 5 stars. We're, you know, I think our net promoter score ranges between 62 and 68, which is, you know, 2x that of the typical health plan. And so you have this virtuous cycle, which is the kind of the foundation of the business.
Yeah.
And it's kind of all born from the simple ideas. You know, it's exactly what you said. I want people to take care of, you know, if we could get people to take care of my parents, you know, the way I want, but then do it at scale.
Yeah.
That's what we're trying to do.
That's great.
So anyways, that's a long-winded answer.
So, you know, kind of, so in the Medicare Advantage market, I guess you've got one force would be, I'm just going to stick with Medicare fee for service. I'm rolling that and then buy a sub policy, right? That's what a member would have. That's one alternative.
Yep.
The other alternative is everybody sees Medicare as a growth opportunity, at least in terms of Medicare Advantage, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And so those are your competitive forces, a Medicare Advantage plan, a new model or more sort of progressive model in terms of care and attention to the sick, or someone chooses fee for service with like a sub policy from, you know, yeah. Mutual Omaha or something like that. So how does the market respond to what you're offering? How do you get the word out, and what type of membership is being, you know, yeah, selecting yeah. you as a provider?
Yeah, no, it's a great question. One of my favorite learnings over this whole past couple of years is just the word TAM.
Yeah, TAM. Everybody loves a TAM.
Everybody loves a TAM. Total addressable market. Right? and so
TAM is very big, John. I just want you to know that.
It's a very big TAM. I mean, there's 60 million, you know, seniors in this country.
Yeah.
And right now there's about a 33% penetration of Medicare Advantage. You know, it's about 30%. That CMS expects that market penetration for Medicare Advantage to go up to about 50% market penetration. Right. So there's a inherent growth in MA, really due to the fact that the economic value equation to the consumer is relatively high. And so what I mean by that is, as you said, a traditional fee-for-service member is augmenting their Medicare with supplemental coverage, and they're paying, you know, somewhere between $300, $400, $500, you know, per month, right, of incremental premium dollars to provide that gap coverage. And so Medicare Advantage will often have zero premiums with very good coverage. And ergo, people are just looking at it and you know, this is pretty good. Then you have different flavors of it. You have PPO, you have HMO. And so inherently, I think the growth of MA is what's causing a lot of the, you know, capital markets to invest in different companies that are serving that population. It's kind of like all boats rise in a rising tide, right? I mean, it's just the pure demographics of it. The issue the other thing is, I think CMS is doing is there's a little bit of a hybrid evolving, and it's called the directly contracted entity model, where you've got the government, you know, evolving their accountable care organization, their ACO programs, into these DCE programs where you have fee-for-service members, people that are chosen to be fee-for-service, participate in one of these DCE programs as a way for value-based care initiatives to be overlaid with the providers working with that fee-for-service population. But be that as it may, it is growing. And it's growing with the big guys, right? The big guys, United, Healthcare,
sure.
Humana, all these guys, they're Anthem, they're all growing in MA. They all want to grow in MA. And we're relatively small. I mean, we're serving, less than 100,000 members. And we're a little bit over $1 billion in revenue. But we're beating the big guys and taking market share from them because of this value proposition that we're providing to the end consumer. And it really goes back to this virtuous cycle. If we spend a lot of our money on systems and data to capture and ingest data, to identify who these high-risk patients are, and then we invested a lot of capital to build a home-based and virtual care team that we employ, nurses, doctors, case managers, etc., to envelop that high-risk member with really good care and treat them like your mom and treat them like your dad. And that's worked. It's bent the cost curve in every single market we've been into. And we've got these. And when we went public, we really went public off of data and proof points, a lot of historical data to show this is what we did. This is how we did it. As opposed to, we're going to do all these great things in the future. This is what we've done. Here's the proof points that show that we have the metrics to support the business thesis. And we're taking share from everybody, actually. And so now, we're 3 months post IPO, the whole emphasis is the kind of replication of this business model. And I always say businesses are good if you can get predictable, if it's predictable, repeatable, and then scalable.
Yeah.
I think we're pretty predictable now. The model is good. I think we've repeated it inside multiple markets in 3 states. And now it's all about, putting infrastructure in place to scale, and we're doing that very methodically.
Is it that you're, clearly it's if you think about the insurance model of the old days, it was an underwritten process, right? Now, with MA, it's really a risk management process, right? You don't really know the medical profile of the member when they sign up. You don't really have the opportunity to sort of reject that member on the basis of anything, right? So I come, whoever shows up, you've got to first figure out, wow, what do we have here? What's the risk associated with that patient, right? Isn't that one of the big skills in trying to figure out what you are managing in the first place?
Absolutely. It's a different business than, commercial underwriting, business. It's a healthcare. It's actually healthcare, and it's having the ability to care for people clinically,
right?
That's really the core of the business. They produce really good clinical outcomes for that member, and I think a lot of the big insurance companies are have not been able to kind of traverse the gap between culturally between insurance underwriting, kind of unit economic contracting, just hammering providers on lower unit economics, and getting into kind of the clinical delivery side. I think you're seeing a lot more of that, right? I mean, you're seeing more insurers, buy primary care practices.
Right.
That's happening with all the different big guys now. But they're building them in separate subsidiaries Because they know in the health plan division, typically, culturally, they don't think the way providers think. And so one of the things we set forth is this whole notion of being a payvider,
sure.
which is really virtually vertically integrated, you know, using technology and clinical expertise to provide that differentiation. And it's really born, we have these values that are really simple, actually. Number one, you just put the member first. It's kind of simple, right? Just whatever you do, just don't worry about it. Just put that member first. Do whatever it takes to make that member happy, that senior happy. Number two, support the doctor. Number three, use data and technology to change healthcare. And number four, have a serving heart. Mm-hmm. Like you got to care.
Right.
It's your mom or my mom. I want somebody that cares. So easy, simple things. Then you kind of do the checklist. You say, well, which one of these big guys actually meet all of these four things? And I would proffer to say, maybe one or two, but not most. You know, not most.
Yeah, sometimes I feel like it's regional too. You know, sometimes they're good in some regions, sometimes not others.
Yeah.
But what's interesting to me is you're having to spend money to save money and improve outcomes.
That's very insightful. You know, so once we identify who the folks are that need the particular care, what we do is we have a model where, you know, we contract and work with community doctors, and as opposed to compete with them. A lot of the provider organizations, they set up shop, they shut up new clinics, they shut up new doctors. We're not doing that. We're working with the community doctors, whether they're independent medical groups or part of large integrated delivery networks. And we work with them and we say, really, the 80% of those members that we have, you guys do a great job with. The 20%, we know you can, because you're well-trained and you're great educated and all that. But you, more often than not, you don't have the resources or the time to see that one polychronic senior that takes an hour of your schedule, not 15 minutes. And so we said, let us help you be an extension of your practice, and let us take all the skills that we have and the clinical teams that we have and help you extend and care for those folks at home, and or using telemedicine and or virtual medicine to monitor and take care of them for you. You're still getting paid, doctor.
Right.
And that's the model, I think, that ultimately is the most efficient. And then if you can wrap all that with, you know, kind of healthcare insurance products that are sold directly to the consumer, that again benefit from the fact that you have very aggressive coverage and benefits because you're the low cost provider in the market, it moves market share, mm-hmm. which is what a lot of the provider partners out there are looking for. They want, you know, they want market share to shift from one hospital system to their hospital system, or from one medical group to their medical group. And the way to do that is through product. So it all kind of links together, but it starts with the data and knowing who is in need of what. And the last thing I'll end but this part by saying, you're going to see more and more personalized medicine, personalized care with respect to acuity, with respect to ethnicity, socioeconomic, you know, kind of position, et cetera. And so what we're doing is we're designing products that are going to be more custom tailored for that individual consumer. And part of what's initiated that is CMS wanting to encourage insurers to provide coverages that meet social determinants of people's health.
Right.
So they've expanded the definition of what a supplemental benefit can be included in your annual coverages. And so, for example, groceries, that's not a traditional healthcare, you know, right?
Yeah,
but
yeah.
There's really, right? It's like people can't eat because they got to make a choice between buying insulin or food. I mean, they're going to get sick. So like have a benefit that allows them to buy groceries. I mean, it's a simple example, but powerful one. And so you can see this convergence between traditional health insurance, in our opinion, at least, and, you know, kind of senior lifestyle development. And I think in the next 3 to 5 years, you know, when I get to be a senior in the next, you know, 7 years or whatever it is, I'm not going to be okay waiting 2 months to see a specialist.
Right.
Or, you know, 3 weeks to see my PCP. I want it, you know, I got my iPhone. I want it now. Right. I mean,
designing a health plan for yourself, John. That's what you're doing.
Well, for our parents first and then for us. Right. Now, right. Cause I think this is where the technology part of this and the automation part of this and the service provider element that you and I were talking about earlier really come into play. Because if you can automate that back end,
right,
and link the back end efficacy to, and this is one of the things that we learned at Trizetto was really just the supply chain of how healthcare actually works. If you can have the most efficient supply chain, you're going to have the lowest cost, which then in turn gives you a competitive advantage to provide higher degrees of value to the consumer. That's how you win. And that's what's leading to us. You know, what we got? We got a, you know, 40% revenue CAGR, a 30% membership CAGR, and we're small, you know, but there aren't a lot of billion-dollar companies, you know, with 40% CAGRs. So I think that's what's given us some confidence that, you know, we're going to do this still methodically, but that this thing can work. And the whole goal is to change healthcare.
So I don't want to take up the rest of your day. I could talk to you about this for a long time. You're dealing with every vector around, you know, the healthcare system. You're taking the sickest people. You're working on building a care model. You're working on work providers. You're trying to add technology. It's a thing. So we've got a bunch of listeners that are managers, you know, that run businesses. So I'd be curious to ask you the question, like, what are the three things you spend with the two things that you as a CEO are spending most of your time on as you start thinking about progressing the business?
So I'll start with myself, first of all, which is, I had to learn that there was a difference between being the founder entrepreneur guy versus being the CEO guy.
Right.
They're just two different jobs. I mean, two fundamentally different jobs, as you know. And I had to make that transition. And so really, you know, that was the first and foremost, I would say, you know, kind of lesson learned. And the job, you know, when you're the founder entrepreneur, I mean, it's just, you know, pure will. Right? I mean, you're doing everything. You're in all the weeds, et cetera. And it's just, you're building your team, and it's just pure will. When you're the CEO, and I'm, you know, again, I'm a young CEO, learning to be a better CEO. And that's really about what I've learned is recruiting,
right?
It's team building the team of people that are better than you, but that can work together and function cohesively as a unified team. So I'm actually very fortunate. And this is a shout out to the private equity guys I work with, General Atlantic and Warburg Pincus. And there's no shortcuts, you know? You know, we tried to expand earlier than we were ready to, skinned our knees, regrouped, and then did really well thereafter. But I think making sure that the infrastructure is in place to support the kind of growth, to maintain quality control, if you will, is really important. but really, you know, recruiting and being particularly vigilant upfront on who you hire and you know, do they have the kind of tenacity and the fight to work through all the challenges that small companies have? I think is the, you know, kind of number one job I have as CEO.
Yeah, it's an interesting thing. Like I would agree with you. As the company grows, you get out of like, what's the product? What are the components of the product, right? And you get more into, well, I need to find a group of people where I can convey that and know they're going to go get it done. And you end up really in the talent management business. And what I say to my folks is, I say, you know, among all the other things, manage your budget, your goals, your objectives, the culture, you got to do three things. You got to build a great team. You got to mentor a successor.
Right.
And prepare for bigger things.
That's right. It's hard.
And those three things are how you know whether that's an SVP.
That's right.
Next step of the company or not.
Totally agree. And you know, having me do that with my team,
right?
And now my team has to do the same thing. To your point,
exactly.
Otherwise, you can't grow it. The other thing I would say is, you know, when you get big enough, you know, it's like you have to manage through this growth process where you've got very innovative, you know, kind of entrepreneurial, and I would say subject matter experts actually know how to build things. But when you get big enough, you got to bring in people that have, you know, big company process improvement skills,
right?
You know, metrics driven capability. I mean, all that big company stuff, and then being able to blend the two skills together is another challenge, right? Is an opportunity as well as a challenge for the CEO, because you have to have the ability to get to that third leg, which is scaling. And that the way you scale is through a disciplined, you know, process-centric performance improvement process. But some of these guys, the newer folks, they may not know the level of detail required from the people that actually built the business, right? So the difference between people that can build, you know, at a molecular level and of folks that you need that are managing, and you kind of need both, right? You get big enough, you need both. So that's something that you know is something that's top of mind. You know, just from a, you know, growing the business perspective.
Great conversation, John. I could keep going, but I think we've probably bumped up against our time. So really enjoy talking with you. Last thing. How do people find out about Alignment? Are you guys blogging? Are you tweeting? Are you writing white papers? How can they find, beyond your public disclosure, financial stuff, IR stuff, what are you guys doing to keep yourself out there for?
Yeah. It's, you know, we're big enough now that I think people can expect to see that in the next, you know, 6 months or a year.
Okay. Great talking to you. And thanks for joining us.